Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Life after Holbrook, a year into the surge. Apparently, the unexpected death of Richard Holbrook leaves a diplomatic void right in the soft spot of the Afghanistan war, which is Pakistan. Holbrook had especially good relations with the Pakistani government, even as his relationship with President Obama was fraying. Here is Holbrook in December of last year talking about the Afghanistan war in two-nation terms.
It is obviously true that the people who did the attack were driven east into Pakistan. And that's why we now talk about Afghanistan and Pakistan as an interrelated situation. And I will state right up front that success in one country requires success in both. We will not be able to succeed in Afghanistan unless our Pakistan policy is equally successful. While the troops are in Afghanistan, the hard core of our core enemy is next door.
Now, Holbrook's death comes just as the White House is scheduled to release its one-year assessment tomorrow of how the troop surge is going in the war. The New York Times reports today that the CIA and Pentagon disagree about the state of the war. Steve Clemens is back with us to talk about this, once a foreign policy official in the Clinton administration, now the author of the popular blog The Washington Note, and a fellow at the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation, the progressive think tank. Hi, Steve. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be with you, Brian.
Did you know Richard Holbrook personally?
Very well, and it's a real loss for his friends and his teams of people he worked with, and folks like me he would wrestle with, but he was a very good friend.
When's the last time you talked to him? What did you talk about?
About 2 weeks ago, I was getting him to say yes to my attending what was a Shura meeting. He's organized in the U.S. government on a weekly basis a meeting of all the key officials that are involved with Afghanistan and Pakistan policy, and he called it the Shura meeting, much like the Shura councils in Afghanistan. And there had been no internal report of these by any journalist or blogger of these meetings, and I was trying to be the first, and he was just about to say yes when this all came undone.
Using every bit of your own diplomatic skills. This reputation, Steve, that he had for being a bulldozer, I keep seeing that word. The word steamroller, you know, didn't serve Elliot Spitzer very well when he adopted it as his image as governor of New York. And for a diplomat, I mean, bulldozer isn't a very diplomatic word. What did that mean regarding Richard Holbrook?
Well, if you read my blog, The Washington Note, this morning, I've taken exception to the use of that term to describe him because it only gets half of Richard Holbrook. He could be, I called him basically a turbocharged chameleon where he could turn on the soft charm and he could demonstrate restraint. He could do whatever needed to be done to achieve the goal he was after. Martin Indyk wrote a piece in the New Republic this morning. Martin Indyk, of course, is the head of foreign policy programs at Brookings, where he also made this comment of Richard as a diplomatic bulldozer, and I said this really doesn't capture the full breadth of Richard Holbrook's ability to twist and shape himself into whatever he needed to achieve a victory. So the caricature just doesn't work.
And so you have to have the bulldozer side, and then you have to have
the
soft.
Bulldozer side, certainly with Slobodan Milosevic, there's no doubt, yeah. But and also to some degree with Karzai. But he wasn't a bulldozer alone. He did go after what he wanted, but I had seen him so frequently. And you have to remember, this guy was someone from very early on that was reported that he had clashed with Obama, that Jim Jones and he didn't get on well, that Stanley McChrystal and he were at odds. And to some degree with McChrystal and Jones, he served by both of them bureaucratically. But he didn't do that by being a bulldozer. He did it by tucking his head under and keeping his eye on his portfolio at key times and organizing protection for himself that the other two didn't have.
I guess that's how you become a really skillful diplomat who can get things done. On the one hand, you can really turn on the charm. On the other hand, you can go beyond that and be a bulldozer when you need to be, correct?
Absolutely. And I think this was that would have been you know, the hallmark description of Richard Holbrooke, who could be soft and hard. But he was tenaciously, of all the diplomats I've known, the most tenaciously committed to delivering on results that I've ever met. And one of my, you know, friendly criticisms of many of my friends in the sort of humanitarian global justice community is that very frequently they get the sentiment right and the moral outrage right, and they want to do stuff, but they can't necessarily organize a playbook from a public policy perspective of what are you willing to gamble and trade away to achieve the result in Darfur, or achieve the results, you know, in some great democracy-promoting or human rights-promoting cause. And Richard Holbrooke was practically, you know, Nixonian or Kissingerian, and I use it in a complimentary way, in the sense of his ability to not get lost in moral choices about the means of that he would approach a task. And he was very focused on the morality or the progressive end that he was trying to do. He was head of a global business council on AIDS, for instance, organized the largest collective of major corporations in the world to help on AIDS issues. He did a lot in the outside of government, but he was very progressively oriented, but very open, almost a Machiavelli, if you will, in how you achieve those things. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what made him truly great and truly different than any other diplomat out there today.
How would you compare Secretary of State Clinton's diplomatic style to Holbrooke's?
I think Hillary Clinton has many strengths. And, of course, he was very, very loyal to Hillary Clinton, and she protected him as well in key moments. I think he gave her strategic depth. But when you would compare them line item by line item, I think that Richard Holbrooke had so many ways in which he could contort himself and move himself. And she, in comparison, and I don't mean this as a criticism, is a bit more rigid and predictable. Richard's ability to be unpredictable is what gave him latitude, and his, he didn't get lost in ideology. He just didn't, and I think that he also had a kind of big level moral compass that was in ways shaped by Vietnam, and his very public commentary. Even recently, I was with Richard about a month ago at a big State Department function where he was speaking. I was sitting next to Henry Kissinger, and it was a release of these foreign relations volumes of the United States focused on Southeast Asia and Vietnam in the early parts of the war. And Richard very publicly said what a mistake Vietnam was for the United States. I asked him at this public function how his role then of building, you know, rural structures and dealing with civil society development in Vietnam differed from his role today. They're very similar with Afghanistan. And he went through a couple of the minor similarities, or the differences in terms of, you know, the 9/11 attacks, et cetera, et cetera. But then he went on with a lot of the structural similarities between Afghanistan and with Vietnam, and you could feel in his commentary skepticism about America's Afghanistan project. And I found this really revealing, given the final words he's alleged to have said before he was sedated for surgery, telling his doctor and family that we've got to end the Afghanistan war.
But when that was reported in detail, it sounded like it was a joke, like he was involved in some banter during pain with the doctor, and end the war didn't mean withdraw the troops like end the war meant during the Vietnam era, but kind of meant like, come on, we got to do something about this. Or do you read it differently?
I heard P.J. Crowley's comments, the spokesman of the State Department is P.J. Crowley, and I heard his comments that largely reflected in this humor. I think it is just a capstone to a Shakespearean life where he's created something that all of us are going to grab and use. All I can tell you is I talked to a very senior member of his staff yesterday who was flying back to the United States, who was a great Afghan expert, and I shouldn't mention the person's name, but I said, what do you think about these words? And he said, Steve, those are my instructions from the boss. We're all going to work as hard as we can to take these last words and make them mean something. So while I understand P.J. Crowley's spin, I don't think that his team members looked at it the same way that the State Department is reporting.
P.J. Crowley, the State Department spokesman. My guest is Steve Clemens, author of the Washington Note blog, fellow at the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation. He worked in the Clinton administration. He knew Richard Holbrooke for 15 years. So if Richard Holbrooke's last words were end the war, does that mean withdraw because this is futile, or does that mean win the war?
My view on Richard is it means do what you can, get the farmers on, you know, other crops, help improve their lives as best you can, shrink the military footprint. My view is Richard believed that our military footprint, while he felt that the use of the military was needed to put pressure, I think he believed that the way in which we were deploying the military was ginning up as much trouble as it was solving. So he was not an advocate of withdrawal, but he was an advocate of shrinking or redefining the footprint of the military, and that we needed to be focusing a lot more heavily on reconciliation strategies and negotiation strategies.
Now, I gather that Richard Holbrooke was being increasingly marginalized by the president, though protected by his old friend Hillary Clinton, maybe at these shores that you described. What went wrong between Holbrooke and Obama?
I think President Obama, on occasion, gets, particularly early in his administration, would feel ruffled if someone came in with all the answers, came in forcefully, spoke a lot, didn't respect the aura, if you will, of the president, you know, who might look as someone who might be prone to engage in bureaucratic tussles, and I think that all of those, from President Obama's perspective, might have looked like Richard was potentially, you know, difficult, you know, a difficult teammate, and you know, President Obama wanted to get a team to work together and to work cooperatively, but he had some real titans: Jim Jones, Stanley McChrystal, David Petraeus, Carl Eikenberry, Doug Lute, and Richard Holbrooke, all on the Afghanistan portfolio and all fundamentally at war with each other, and I think that amongst those, Holbrooke looked to Obama as the one with the greatest capacity to undermine. And I think that the fact is Holbrooke had the greatest capacity to actually pull things together. He was criticized by Jim Jones, the National Security Advisor, for pulling functions of government that already existed together. Richard had put together on his own team this interagency task force, which he was building out of the State Department, about 17 different agencies and departments that had representatives. They worked together every week. All of these people were seconded to the group. I visited this group many times, and it was remarkable how well they worked together. It was remarkable. Richard Holbrooke was single-handedly reshaping the way the national security bureaucracy, which is typically pretty dysfunctional, was working. And I think that he had rivals in government who were jealous and worried about what that could mean given their own turf. And so to a certain degree, this capacity and his larger-than-life style was threatening to President Obama to some degree. And so they did get kind of cold. But as I was at a reception last night of his friends and family with many of the top people in government, and there were people kind of quietly commenting that it is very interesting that the night before last, President Obama gave comments about Richard Holbrooke as if they had always been great friends and as if he had always depended on Richard Holbrooke. So Obama has revised his perspective on Richard posthumously, but there were a lot of people who think that President Obama drew on Holbrooke's strengths too late in the game.
From what I've been reading, Holbrooke was viewed unfavorably by the Afghanistan government, maybe because he was trying to be tough on corruption there, but very favorably by Pakistan. And yet, despite Holbrooke's popularity with perhaps our most important and most troublesome ally at the moment, Pakistan, the one-year assessments of the surge that have been leaking out seem to say the biggest problem is that Pakistan is still not getting tough enough on the Taliban fighters on their side of the border who cross over to Afghanistan at will and are the biggest military threat in the entire war. So did he really accomplish much there?
I think he held things together. I think, you know, my view is we're not accomplishing much in terms of the big goals there. I think, you know, the United States is caught in a very complex vice between a civil war going on inside Afghanistan and a proxy war going on top between many of its neighbors, including Pakistan and India. So I think in terms of stabilizing and, you know, getting some relief and focus on the Pakistan flooding, of generating largely stable relations with Zardari and, more importantly, General Kayani in Pakistan and whatnot. I think that when you look at all the available options, in my view, they're all pretty bad. Richard, in the non-military dimensions of the AFPAC portfolio, did a very good job. In fact, I just received word literally 2 minutes ago over the internet I mean, it's not been publicly announced, but over my email, that President Zardari is going to confer the Hilal A. Pakistan, or Crescent of Pakistan, award on Richard Holbrooke, their highest civilian award, which has only been given to Richard Nixon, Joe Biden, and John Kerry. So they're doing that. On the Afghan side, something I wrote this morning on the blog is, I said, you know, Holbrooke had six relationships with Karzai. You have to remember, the first administration to begin trying to wash their hands of Karzai was the Bush administration, and Bob Gates was the lead. And this is the environment that the Obama administration came into with Karzai. And Richard's job was to try to get the Afghan citizens to have trust in the evolution of a true democratic stakeholding society in which they felt that they had greater stakes, and that meant elections and being having fair and free elections. Karzai looked at this as a huge threat, and they did have a huge problem. But, you know, people keep mentioning Holbrooke's bad relationship with Karzai. He had a bad relationship with Karzai, and he had a great relationship with Karzai. He had a mediocre relationship with Karzai. Holbrooke reconstructed his relationship given whatever the task of the day was. And I know that in April 2009, when Richard had his first heart scare, in fact, he leaked it to me, and the Washington Note first, I was in his office, and he had to temporarily take himself out of going on a trip with Petraeus. It was a key trip to Petraeus because the Holbrooke-Karzai relationship had melted down so badly that he got a clean bill of health at that time, went over with Petraeus, and Holbrooke and Karzai went out of their way to reconstruct a very positive relationship with each other. So I think people need to look at the fact that it's not the envoy's job to be loved and hugging Karzai, because it's, you know, that it's his job to try to secure the results on corruption, on a democratic order, on, you know, getting agricultural conversion and all these other things. So I think sometimes the media amplifies certain lenses that just don't make sense given what is you know, a clear picture of the fact that a diplomat has to be many different things and have different kinds of relationships with leaders.
My guest for just another few minutes, and then Congressman Anthony Weiner is going to join us, by the way, talk about the latest on the tax compromise coming to the House and whether Democrats in the House will approve it. My guest until then, just a few more minutes, is Steve Clemens, once a foreign policy official in the Clinton administration, now author of the popular blog The Washington Note, and fellow at the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation, the progressive think tank. So the official one-year assessments of the Obama surge are due out tomorrow. They're already leaking out, with the CIA more pessimistic than the Pentagon, as I guess is typical of both. You've been a skeptic of this surge from the beginning. What do you think we'll officially hear, and how do you think it's going?
We're going to hear two things tomorrow. We're going to hear that the July 2011 transfer of authority to the Afghan security troops remains on track, that the president remains committed to the July 2011 date, but that we will continue to follow facts on the ground and blah, blah, blah. We will also hear that the situation remains tough, that the strategy remains sound, that we are going to continue with the course that they had laid. I'm disappointed in this. I'm glad that they're going to stick with the July 2011, you know, punctuation point per se as a beginning of a drawdown. But at the same time, I think that what people are clamoring for and what's happened over the last year is that the military has failed to deliver on any of the key benchmarks that they had said they would be able to achieve with a surge up in the number of troops.
They're going to say
at some point you have to get accountability.
They're going to say they've achieved benchmarks in Kandahar and Helmand, aren't they?
They may say that, but the CIA and national intelligence estimates that are coming out are disputing that.
And the Pentagon will say
the problem is you have a dispute. You do not have an unambiguous
consensus
read that the military has achieved their goals.
Right. And according to the New York Times today, the Pentagon will dispute that national intelligence assessment and say that's a dated assessment because it closed on October 1st and things have actually changed since then, as well as that they don't have the boots on the ground and they do those things from desks in Washington. But that will be a dispute. Last thing before you go. Some of the WikiLeaks State Department cables were obviously about Afghanistan and Pakistan. The whole prior WikiLeaks release was Afghanistan war oriented. Has information that has come through WikiLeaks enhanced your understanding of the war in any important ways?
Yeah, here and there. I mean, it's certainly the great thing about WikiLeaks is it gives you granular detail of what people think, where they are. I mean, they're fascinating. I think every political science course, foreign policy course in colleges and universities should be doing this because they're fascinating portals through which to look to these questions. But the biggest and most significant ones, and it's where I think, you know, sometimes I worry about the impact of the WikiLeaks, are the relationships between Zardari and General Kayani. And you really do get a sense of how much the military in Pakistan runs everything. And that has implications for Pakistan and how they view the Taliban and their stewardship, if you will, their appreciation, use of the Taliban to give Pakistan strategic depth. What you do is you get a sense from WikiLeaks and some of the things in there how getting Pakistan to move away from, really to move against the Taliban, is probably folly. And this is going to be part of the debate that we hear that breaks after President Obama's comments tomorrow, because everyone is saying that Pakistan is not doing what needs to be done to shut down the al-Qaeda / insurgent havens in Pakistan that keep running across the border and disrupting Afghanistan. That what you see is Pakistan's strategic choice that the Taliban is one of their key instruments. And it's very hard to be allied with Pakistan and pumping $2 billion of aid into Pakistan while you see many generals and the command staff looking at our enemy in Afghanistan as their ally. And that's very much in the WikiLeaks document, and I think it just makes it clear as day.
20 seconds. Are you a fan of WikiLeaks or the Army's alleged WikiLeaker? Are you sending money to Julian Assange's bail fund?
No, I'm not sending money. I have mixed views. Look, Bob Woodward and David Sanger of the New York Times and others have gotten all sorts of leaks, and I think that the WikiLeaks has been a journalistic leveler. I think, though, when WikiLeaks comes out with, you know, statements about deficits in American infrastructure, that you know, biotoxins and whatnot, that's a line that should never have been crossed. So I view WikiLeaks as the wave of the future. Every government that lives digitally is going to have this happen to them, and it's going to be a fascinating ride. But ultimately, I think it's mixed that those that are doing the leaking need to find a responsible way to do it. But WikiLeaks, you have to understand, is a market response to the growth of official secrecy in the United States. And the American government has a lot of culpability in creating a climate where it has classified so much that should never have been classified. And so it's a mixed picture, but I feel strongly that the U.S. government has got to reform what it considers, what it holds back from the public.
Steve Clemens from New America Foundation and The Washington Note, we really appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Congressman Wiener up next.